So this is our Merleau Ponty reading group, continuing our reading of the structure of behavior. We are in the last chapter of the book. I think we have like about 30 pages left, 30, 40 pages. So we should probably wrap up in next month or so, depending on how far we get each time. Yeah, so the last couple things that we've been reading have to do with the previous or the historical accounts of the relationship between body and soul is the sort of traditional terminology, but you can, in maybe the specific terminology of this book, it would be the relationship between the physical and vital orders on the one hand, and then the psychical or human order on the other hand. And so he talks a little bit, or he has a couple pages of discussion of Descartes, and because this is, of course, sort of the classical instance of this problem. You know, we have the res extensa, the extended thing, which is the physical universe, including human bodies. And then we have the res cogitans, the thinking thing, so the human soul. And these are utterly distinct entities for Descartes. They have no properties in common. But of course, in our sort of normal conception of what it is to be a human being and our understanding of ourselves, we take it that our perception of the world around us has to do with, in some way, some complicated way that we don't understand. It involves some kind of physical interaction between my body and the environment. So light rays striking my retina, for example, and then something happens mysteriously, and that brings about an experience of seeing a table or whatever. And then in the other direction, I can make a decision to do something. And again, in this mysterious way that we don't understand, that brings about a movement of, say, my hand to pick up the coffee cup. So this is our sort of general, like, default understanding that there's this two-way interaction between my soul or my mind and my body. But if these are utterly distinct entities with no properties in common, it's not exactly clear how that interaction is supposed to happen. And so Descartes, is at least honest enough to say that, this is a big problem, and it's actually something that he says surpasses human understanding. So we just have to accept that God has set things up in such a way that, this seeming interaction between soul and body happens, but we have no way of understanding, what exactly that consists in or how it works. But there's a lot of reasons to think this is like not an especially satisfying way of dealing with this problem. And so there's various other attempts. And so he talks about the Kantian. It's not sort of directly. He's not doing like Kant exegesis here, but this sort of criticist or intellectualist position, which would or transcendental idealist, which would try to solve this problem essentially by absorbing the physical worlds or res extensa into the realm of knowledge. So I have a perception, for example, this perceptual experience of a table or a desk. But we should understand this desk as an object of a judgment. So it's a sort of intellectual construct that I put together out of various sensory experiences. And then a sort of, I guess, folk theory of physics that, if I sort of, when I perceive a desk, I have a intuitive understanding or sort of implicit understanding that, if I touch it, my hand won't pass through the desk, for example. If I try to pick it up, it will have a certain weight, et cetera, like all these different properties that we, expect physical objects to have. So essentially, perception is like a implicit theorization of the world or implicit scientific depiction of the world. And then science as such is just sort of like an extension of perception, where we systematize things, make things coherent with each other, explain phenomena that seem hard to understand in like a sort of naive approach to the world, et cetera. What Merleau Ponty points out is kind of a problem with this is that it sort of deals with this connection between the body and the soul or the body and the mind by like dissolving the body. It's hard to understand on this conception. Why would it be the case that my experience, this sort of mental event, something happening in my mind, which is this sort of implicit scientific theory. Why is it that that experience is sort of limited to the point of view of my body? Like, you know, I'm seeing this desk from this angle. I see one side of it and not the other. Clearly that has something to do with the fact that my body is located in a certain position relative to that desk. But it's not, if my body is just, you know, a physical object like any other, then it's again, it's just a sort of intellectual construction that I put together out of, you know, my various sensory experiences of that body. So why should one, you know, group or construction out of sensory experiences have this sort of role of being the origin point of my relationship to all the other constructions out of sensory experience? There's nothing, you know, intrinsic about, you know, when I see my hand, for example, you know, the visual perception of that hand that makes it, you know, my hand as opposed to someone else's hand, just at the level of intellectual constructions. It kind of, for this account, like if you sort of push it to the limit, you end up with like experience or the sort of perceptual side of the world is essentially just a privation, that the world is in itself this sort of scientifically depicted structure, and then our perceptual access to the world is just a sort of confused or incomplete scientific theory. So this is completely antithetical to Merleau-Ponty's whole approach, of course, where he wants to, you know, treat the perceptual world as something positive in itself, that like it's not, the perception is not a sort of incomplete science. It's a domain or an element of human life that has its own, you know, consistency and structure and so on. So that's like the contrast that he's going to drive towards. How can we understand the world as having these kinds of structures? You know, the fact that I know that the desk is, you know, will have a certain weight if I try to pick it up, etc. All this stuff that is correctly grasped by the criticist approach without sort of dissolving the world of experience into like a sort of incomplete science. So what is it that's positive about perception? That's the problem that we're sort of dealing with at this point. So I think that's a good place to stop here. If someone can pick up from the heading on 201, is there not a truth of naturalism?
I can read. Is there not a truth of naturalism? Are we compelled in this direction by the preceding analyses? At least they lead to the transcendental attitude, that is, to a philosophy which treats all conceivable reality as an object of consciousness. It has seemed to us that matter, life, and mind could not be defined as three orders of reality, or three sorts of beings, but as three planes of signification, three forms of unity. In particular, life would not be a force which is added to physico-chemical processes. Its originality would be that of modes of connection without equivalent in the physical domain, that of phenomena gifted with a proper structure and which can bind each other together according to a special dialectic. In a living being, bodily movements and moments of behavior can be described and understood only in a specially tailored language and in accordance with the categories of an original experience. And it is in this same sense that we have recognized a psychological order and a mental order. But these distinctions then are those of different regions of experience. We have been moved from the idea of a nature as omnitudo realitatis to the idea of objects which could not be conceived in themselves, en soi, partes extra partes, and which are defined only by an idea in which they participate, by a signification which is realized in them. Since the relations of the physical system and the forces which act upon it and those of the living being and its milieu are not the external and blind relations of juxtaposed realities, but dialectical relations in which the effect of each partial action is determined by its signification for the whole, the human order of consciousness does not appear as a third order superimposed on two others, or on the two others, but as their condition of possibility and their foundation. The problem of the relations of the soul and the body seems to disappear from the point of view of this absolute consciousness, milieu of the universe, as it did from the critical point of view. There can be no question of a causal operation between three planes of signification. One says that the soul, quote-unquote, acts on the body when it happens that our conduct has a rational signification, that is, when it cannot be understood by any play of physical forces or by any of the attitudes which are characteristic of the vital dialectic. In reality, the expression is improper. We have seen that the body is not a self-enclosed mechanism on which the soul could act from the outside. It is defined only by its functioning, which can present all degrees of integration. To say that the soul acts on the body is wrongly to suppose a univocal notion of the body, and to add to it a second force, which accounts for the rational signification of certain conducts. In this case, it would be better to say that bodily functioning is integrated with a level which is higher than that of life, and that the body has truly become a human body. Inversely, one will say that the body has acted on the soul. The behavior can be understood without residue in terms of the vital dialectic or by known psychological mechanisms. Here again, one does not, properly speaking, have a right to imagine a transitive action from substance to substance, as if the soul were a constantly present force whose activity would be held in check by a more powerful force. It would be more exact to say that the behavior had become disorganized, leaving room for less integrated structures. In brief, the alleged reciprocal action is reducible to an alternation or a substitution of dialectics, since the physical, the vital, and the mental individual are distinguished only as different degrees of integration. To the extent that man is completely identified with the third dialectic, that is, to the extent he no longer allows systems of isolated conduct to function in him, his soul and his body are no longer distinguished. So yeah, in this first paragraph, he recaps this idea that we can't explain, or he doesn't find satisfactory the, transcendentally real accounts of the distinctions between the orders of matter, life, and mind, as he laid out in this chapter and the last one. For Merleau-Ponty, these are phenomenal distinctions, or significations, as he puts it here. And then the relation between the soul and the body seems to be a matter of degrees of integration. So in his previous discussion of Freud, he talked about how complex, as he put it, only has a causal influence on a person's psyche where it hasn't been fully integrated into that person's life. And so rather than seeing this, you know, the soul as a substance acting on a separate substance, which is the body, he's suggesting that the soul acts, so to speak, when the subordinate dialectics are fully, taken up into a higher and more properly human structure of behavior.
Yeah, it's this sort of standard, way of presenting things that he uses, throughout this book, of, wanting to understand this relationship between this human, properly human order and or the psychological order, as he calls it, the vital order or the physical order, not as sort of an addition of connection between two things that would already exist or have their subsistence independent of each other. So again, this was this whole sort of criticism of the reflex theory, and then the forms of association or all these other attempts to sort of get beyond the reflex theory. His objection in general to these theories was that they start from this notion of like two atoms that are independent of each other, that each have their inherent existence, and then sort of secondarily get connected. And for him, this is not a real solution to the problem. And so again, at the level of at the much more abstract or higher order level that he's describing here, if we assume that there is this physical world, intrinsically existing, that has its own inherent structure, and then the psychological world, and then some sort of causal interaction between the two, then we're still left with the same kinds of problems. So we have to instead see the human body, insofar as it is, incorporated into the psychological order as like a whole unity, I guess, not as like a physical body and a mind, and then somehow they get connected to each other. So when, for example, I use my hands to play the piano or to make a painting or even, you know, something more sort of banal, like, you know, cooking or something, it's not the case that there's like, on the one hand, these, you know, movements of a certain portion of matter that can be described in geometrical terms, and then also some like things going on in the mind of a certain person that are, you know, associated with those movements of portions of matter. And then this would be like sort of the accurate description of what's going on when, you know, when I'm cooking or when I'm playing piano or whatever. We instead have to see the movements of my hands and the rest of my body as well as intrinsically ensouled or psychological or the sort of psychological or meaningful character of those movements is intrinsic to the to those movements as such. It's not something that's sort of added on or projected onto the movements. This is sort of what he's drawing from all those discussions of animal behavior, for example, where you can't make sense of the animal's behavior unless you already understand what is significant for that animal, what kinds of goals does that animal pursue, what kinds of elements of its environment present for it in terms of, you know, things that it can actually perceive in the first place, and then out of what it can perceive in the first place, which of those things is it going to pay attention to? So you have to start from this level of signification, which is neither sort of internal to one person's psychological stream of consciousness, nor a physical body or, you know, a property of physical bodies. You start from this level of signification, and then you can understand this physical order and this sort of internal psychological description as being sort of products of or abstracted from this level of signification. So that's where we have to start. It's sort of a inside-out strategy where we start from the signification and move outwards towards physical and psychological descriptions, as opposed to, you know, an outside-in strategy where we would start with these two external orders, the psychological description and then the physical description, and then try to figure out how it is the case that some action, some movement of a portion of matter in space has the role of expressing a psychological state or corresponding to a psychological state or whatever. Starting from that signification and then moving outwards as opposed to the other way around.
One thing I'd like to get a better handle on as we work through these pages tonight is what exactly Merleau-Ponty means by dialectic and kind of dialectical resolution and dialectical unity. As he often uses that word to describe the integration of physical and vital unities into psychic or symbolic signification.
Yeah, this is, I think, kind of the eternal problem both that we've come across both in Simondon and in Merleau-Ponty, is like, what exactly are we supposed to take dialectics to mean? I'm not sure. I don't think he ever gives like a, like, here's my understanding of what dialectics means, like sort of presentation. So like at a sort of first approximation, it clearly has to do with interaction. So the fact that the, you know, vital and psychological orders are only comprehensible in terms of how they interact with each other. That's one, like, maybe first necessary but not sufficient condition to be able to describe them as dialectical. And I think that's the next bit that Batz has put in his comment here, is that they're not abstractable from each other. Or maybe how I would put it is that when we describe them as separate from each other, that is always an abstraction. That's a sort of secondary step. The sort of first, the what's primary is the unity of them, the vital and the psychological, and then if we sort of treat them as independent realms or try to separate them from each other. That's an abstraction that may be useful in certain circumstances, but is not sort of the fundamental reality of how these realms, you know, of what these realms are. So it's, yeah, this interaction or unity of the two is prior to the, in ontological terms, it's more fundamental than each of them taken in isolation. I think that's like, at least captures like the necessary conditions for something to be, an instance of dialectics for Merleau-Ponty. There may be other conditions that are also necessary. I think those are like the two sort of key points. Yeah, so interaction and then the priority of the interaction over the two term or two or more terms that are interacting. Yeah, it's a good question here from that. Does this concept of dialectical imply something more concrete, more than that sort of abstract description as I was setting it out? Or is it the case that the specific relationship between the two poles of whatever dialectical relationship or process is being discussed, this is something that is specific to each instance of a dialectical relationship? I'm not 100% sure, but it seems like the way that Merleau-Ponty is using this term is that each instance of dialectics or of a dialectical relationship has its own structure or its own like way of making concrete this more abstract characterization that I presented it. So like at the top of 203, that bit that we just read, he talks about how, or like, bottom of 202 to top of 203, he's talking about how there are these sort of possibilities in the case of human behavior to sort of have varying degrees of incorporation in each of these forms of dialectic. So like someone who is you can say, I guess, healthy or, quote unquote, normal. In this case, you can understand their actions purely in terms of this human order, this level of signification. But you can describe, what the person is doing by moving their hands in a certain way, etc. And then maybe like the other extreme would be someone who has, some kind of tremor or other kind of movement disorder. So like all these patients who had brain damage that Goldstein was studying, and these patients, are not capable of controlling the movement of their hands. And then, so to describe, what is happening when this person's hand moves, you have to appeal to a physical explanation or a vital explanation, something about, the movement of neurotransmitters and, the way that different chemicals are, operating. You can explain this movement in those terms, but the movement has no signification. The person is not, trying to do something or trying to express something by, having their hands shake. And so in this case, the movement of the hands is sort of doesn't get incorporated or not fully incorporated into the human order, the psychological order, this level of signification, and instead is sort of extracted from that order and has this physical order of connections and causal effects that is bringing about this movement. And so I think what this suggests, at least, is that each of these, the movement of the hands in the case of this person who has the tremor is sort of involuntarily removed from this dialectic that is the human order and is instead put into this dialectic of the physical order. And this is like each of these orders seems to have its own dialectic that brings about the kinds of operations or effects or whatever that happen at that order, and how these entities that are governed by this dialectic, what their behavior and transformations are going to be. It seems like each of these orders has its own sort of structure of dialectics and is governed by its own, I guess, laws or principles.
Yeah, I think also it doesn't seem like there's anything. There doesn't seem to be a strongly normative component to sort of what can be integrated into like a higher unity of a symbolic form of life, as we'll see very shortly in the example of El Greco. I can't remember what, maybe it was in astigmatism. And he also talks about Beethoven's deafness, gives these as examples of components which could have been merely physical, but were successfully resolved into the higher dialectical unity of the lives of El Greco and Beethoven, which I thought that was cool. It doesn't seem to be like you don't have to have you don't have to be like a person who can hear, or you don't have to have perfectly functioning vision for Merleau-Ponty in order to, be a completely integrated symbolic form of life.
Yeah, I think already with Goldstein, he already points out like one of his sort of key arguments against a more sort of associationist or localization oriented account of behavior is that the patient who has suffered some sort of brain damage or other injury is not just a quote unquote normal patient with some function subtracted from their behavioral repertoire. So like someone has suffered damage to an area of the brain that is involved in speech, for example. It's not just that this is like, a normal person and then with the ability to speak subtracted. Instead, you have like this restructuring of that person's behavior to sort of adapt to this new reality where certain things that used to be possible are no longer possible. You have to do something different. So if you are not capable of if the speech issue has to do with like articulation of sounds, for example, which sometimes happens with like damage to Broca's area, then you would maybe like resort to writing to communicate with other people. You would write down what it is you're trying to say. Whereas damage to like there's other types of damage that can affect like semantic memory or retrieval of a word. And so someone with this kind of brain damage would not be able to write down instructions on a piece of paper or whatever. They would have to do something different to sort of adapt to this new set of abilities and inabilities that they're faced with. But in each case, like it's never the case that someone who has suffered an injury or damage of some kind is just the same as they were before minus some function. Instead, they have to reorient their whole pattern of behavior to work around this difficulty and to accomplish the things that they need to accomplish to with the capacities that they still have. And even like at the very banal level, like someone who suffers an injury that affects their movement will probably not continue to work as a surgeon, for example. They'll probably have to find a different job that doesn't require fine motor skills in the same way, et cetera. So you change where you work, you might change what kind of the layout of your house, et cetera. All these things will change, and you restructure your whole life around this set of behaviors. In some sense, there's this physical level of this nerve has suffered damage. That means that this type of control of the limb is no longer possible. So you can describe that just in terms of physiology. But then this inability to perform certain types of movement is something that is incorporated into this human level, where some things like changing your job, for example, because of this loss of a capacity. All of these changes to what kinds of behaviors are possible are incorporated into this human level, way of governing the pattern of your life. And then even at a more abstract or like bigger picture level, people will try to make sense of their life what does it mean for me as a person that I can no longer walk or whatever, like how do I like make sense of this as like part of my life story and so on. All these different things, even when there is like a physical explanation for some, you know, change in the way the person, you know, interacts with the world and so on. It's always incorporated into that person's, you know, pattern of behavior, just at the very basic level of what kinds of things they do on a daily basis. And then also into the sort of understanding of that person, you know, how they think of themselves and their life and how they fit into the world and so on. Right. Yeah. And so, yeah. So we would want to distinguish between, yeah, like a sort of adaptation. So yeah, someone who, you know, experiences tremors would probably, you know, quit their job as a surgeon, or they might, you know, in some cases you have like a deficiency in, you know, motor control, for example. But if you sort of, pay extra attention and, you know, move a little bit slower than you normally would, you can still perform the tasks that you were previously capable of. So this kind of adaptation of like, yeah, just maybe allowing yourself more time, or, you know, making sure that you actually are, you know, focusing on picking up the coffee cup and don't just do it casually. Yeah, so this is sort of like a very basic adaptation, which is not, doesn't necessarily have this like signification status, I guess, or it is not necessarily a kind of incorporation into the dialectic of the human order. But then this other level, yeah, I think like the question of the, you know, the surgeon changing jobs, I think that would be more of an instance of integration, you know, where, you know, assuming this surgeon, you know, finds another job that sort of allows them to exercise their capacities that they have now and that, you know, they feel like is, you know, sort of, I guess, a suitable exercise of their abilities and so on. Yeah, that would be a kind of integration as opposed to just this mere adaptation. They have restructured their, you know, situation, their life, and found a way to use the capacities that they have now to achieve things that they want to achieve. So this is, yeah, this would be more of an integration, whereas someone who just sort of comes up with little workarounds and so on to like keep, you know, being able to manipulate objects in their home and so on, despite having suffered an injury, that would be more like an adaptation. So it's probably, I think, a question of degree to some extent of like how extensive of a restructuring it is, but also like adaptation would be more, I guess, of like a filling in a sort of something that's missing, whereas integration would be like something new that develops as a response to the change in the structure of behavior of that person. Okay, so let's go on to the next bit if someone would like to read. Yeah, so we're on 203, I think, right at the top, if one supposes.
Yeah, I can read. If one supposes an anomaly of vision in El Greco, as has sometimes been done, it does not follow that the form of the body in his paintings, and consequently the style of the attitudes, admit of a quote-unquote physiological explanation. When irremediable bodily peculiarities are integrated with the whole of our experience, they cease to have the dignity of a cause in us. A visual anomaly can receive a universal signification by the mediation of the artist and become for him the occasion of perceiving one of the quote-unquote profiles of human existence. The accidents of our bodily constitution can always play this revealing role on the condition that they become a means of extending our knowledge by the consciousness which we have of them, instead of being submitted to as pure facts which dominates us. Ultimately, El Greco's supposed visual disorder was conquered by him and so profoundly integrated into his manner of thinking and being that it appears finally as the necessary expression of his being much more than a peculiarity imposed from the outside. It is no longer a paradox to say that, open quotes, El Greco was astigmatic because he produced elongated bodies, end quotes. Everything which was accidental in the individual, that is, everything which revealed partial and independent dialectics without relationship to the total signification of his life, has been assimilated and centered in his deeper life. Bodily events have ceased to constitute autonomous cycles, to follow the abstract pattern of biology and psychology, and have received a new meaning. It is nevertheless the body, it will be said, which in the final analysis explains El Greco's vision. His liberty consisted only in justifying this accident of nature by infusing it with a metaphysical meaning. Unity does not furnish an adequate criterion of the liberty which has been won, since a man dominated by a complex, for example, and subject to the same psychological mechanism in all his undertakings, realizes unity in slavery. But here it is only a question of an apparent unity, of a stereotyped unity, which will not withstand an unexpected experience. It can be maintained only in a chosen milieu, which the sick person has constructed for himself precisely by avoiding all situations in which the apparent coherence of his conduct would be disorganized. True unity, on the contrary, is recognized from the fact that it is not obtained by a restriction of the milieu. The same sensory or constitutional infirmity can be a cause of slavery if it imposes on man a type of vision and monotonous action from which he can no longer escape, or the occasion of a greater liberty if he makes use of it as an instrument. This supposes that he knows it instead of obeys it. For a being who lives at the simply biological level, it is a fatality. I'll read the next paragraph as well. For a being who has acquired the consciousness of self and his body, who has reached the dialectic of subject and object, the body is no longer the cause of the structure of consciousness. It has become the object of consciousness. Then one can no longer speak of a psychophysiological parallelism. Only a disintegrated consciousness can be paralleled with physiological processes, that is, with a partial functioning of the organism. By acceding to true knowledge, by going beyond the dialectic of the living or the social being and its circumscribed milieu, by becoming the pure subject who knows the world objectively, man ultimately realizes that absolute consciousness with respect to which the body and individual existence are no longer anything but objects. Death is deprived of meaning. Reduced to the status of object of consciousness, the body could not be conceived as an intermediary between quote-unquote things and the consciousness which knows them. And since consciousness, having left the obscurity of instinct, no longer expresses the vital properties of objects, but their true properties, the parallelism here is between consciousness and the true world which it knows directly. All the problems seem to be eliminated. The relations of the soul and the body, obscure as long as the body is treated in abstraction as a fragment of matter, are clarified when one sees in the body a bearer of a dialectic. Since the physical world and the organism can be conceptualized only as objects of consciousness or as significations, the problem of the relations of consciousness and its physical or organic quote-unquote conditions would exist only at the level of a confused thought, which adheres to abstractions. It would disappear in the domain of truth, in which the relation of the epistemological subject and its object alone subsists as original. This would constitute the only legitimate theme of philosophical reflection. Wait, I think it's fine if I stop here, right? Because the next paragraph is kind of long.
Yeah, I think this is one of these sort of extended passages where there's no clear break. Thanks. Let's see, where are we? Sorry, I was kind of multitasking here. So Beethoven, et cetera, where was the last bit we just read?
So I just finished reading the last paragraph of 204.
Okay.
So before, let us consider, right?
Right. Okay. Yeah. So this is I guess the question of how we get to this subject-object sort of separation that is characteristic of that criticist position that I was explaining in the intro bit that Merleau-Ponty wants to criticize. So he's not going to say that this is completely illusory and we should just forget about subject and object altogether. He wants to instead give an account of how it is the case that this subject-object relationship can appear in certain circumstances, like when we're doing science, on the basis of this more fundamental level of signification that appears in perceptual life. What is characteristic of science or this sort of objective depiction of the world as opposed to this perceptual level or this perceptual reality is that we're dealing with what we're aiming at when we do science is the way the world is in itself as opposed to how we interact with it. So we're trying to understand, you know, what exactly is happening in the atmosphere of Jupiter or whatever, and not just like what kinds of experiences or perceptual events occur when I, you know, look at the atmosphere of Jupiter. And so it's a different sort of order of, relationships, I guess, of different elements of the world, in a sense that we are no longer treating these objects as intrinsically connected to a certain perceptual and behavioral grasp of those objects. We're trying to abstract from that human side of things and grasp the things only as they are in themselves. And for this sort of criticist position, this would be like sort of the final picture of the world for the criticist position. So that the picture is that we have this completed science that shows all the different properties of objects as they are, independently of this human perceptual interaction with them. We do experiments, we come up with theories, etc., and then at some point in the infinite future, as we have completed this scientific account of the world, we know what all the properties of these objects are and the structure of how these entities interact with each other and so on. But then the person or being or subject or whatever that actually does the science, that, you know, knows these theories and everything, is like sort of outside of the world, is kind of this like abstract eye looking at the world from outside. So everything that we can deal with is an object of science that is incorporated into the realm of knowledge, and then the subject that is actually doing the science or that has that knowledge is something sort of outside that realm. And we're again left with a kind of dualism, even if it's a different one than the Cartesian one, it leaves like a sort of a paradoxical result that the subject of knowledge is itself not something that is capable of being known in the way that even my body as a physical object can be known in this scientific depiction of the world. It's maybe even more radical disjunction than this Cartesian one. Because for Descartes, the soul is something that is easier to know than the body. I have this immediate knowledge of what is happening in my soul, the cogito, etc. And then I can I have to rely on the veracity of God to infer that what I experience, when I see my body and other bodies around me, is an accurate depiction or corresponds to something real. But this sort of criticist position kind of empties out the mind altogether, that there's nothing that I can know directly or immediately in the way that in the Cartesian picture I could. Everything that I can know is a product of scientific concept construction and sort of this intellectual endeavor. And then the knowledge itself, or the subject of the knowledge, is not something that can ever be known. And of course, Kant has this, the famous paralogism section in the Critique of Pure Reason, which is sort of dealing with this question. He takes it that Descartes is sort of illegitimately passing from the subject sort of as it appears to itself. So when I sort of think about myself, when I take myself to be an object of thought, and then the subject that is thinking, so the I as subject and the I as object, and for Kant, Descartes is illegitimately passing from one to the other, and so this I as subject can never be known, because as soon as you know it, you have turned it into an object. So this sort of radical disjunction between subject and object is even stricter than the Cartesian soul-body disjunction. But again, it leaves this unsatisfying kind of mystery of how is the subject even supposed to be able to perform these intellectual constructions if it's so radically distinct from everything that is an object of knowledge. And then again, the question that I mentioned earlier about like if you depict perception and human experience, etc., as like a as an incomplete scientific account of the world, then the sort of positivity of experience, you know, the fact that it's something, that it is something and not just an absence of a complete scientific picture, that whole positivity of experience is sort of swept away. And so these are sort of the main elements of why this transcendental idealist or this criticist account is not going to be ultimately satisfying for Merleau-Ponty, even if it's an improvement on like this what he considers to be like a naive naturalism that would take our experiential or perceptual grasp of the world to be an effect in the causal series in the physical world.
I just want to say that I think El Greco was astigmatic because he produced elongated bodies is an extremely cool quote and idea.
Yeah, and this connects, I mean, he doesn't really develop this thought, but we were just mentioning this in the chat here. So Deleuze talks about this poet or writer, Joe Bousquet, who was injured during World War I. I think it was a shell that landed near him that left him mostly paralyzed. And he, later would write about how, he has this passage that Deleuze cites about how my wound preexisted me and I was born to incarnate it. Of course, suffering this injury that leaves you paralyzed is devastating to, your whole interaction with the world, and I'm sure did not make writing easier for him. But at the same time, he has like taken this traumatic event and incorporated it into something like a signification of his life, that this is like something that makes sense in some way, even if it in some other way does not make sense. It's just this random fact that a shell happened to land near where he was located. And this is like, this account of like how my wound preexisted me also. And I think that is makes a connection in terms of the Stoic concept of destiny. This idea that there's like a kind of pre-existing order of events that are like realized in the physical interactions of bodies. And Merleau-Ponty doesn't go in that direction, but you could ask if there's this relationship between El Greco's astigmatism and the way that he paints, is this like, should we understand this in terms of something like a destiny, that like this becoming astigmatic was like this sort of pre-existing possibility that he like realized in his life later on, or how exactly we're supposed to understand this this relationship between it's not a purely causal relationship that Merleau-Ponty is describing. There's some sort of intrinsic relationship between this, drawing bodies in this elongated way and the astigmatism. So it's not too clear exactly what we're supposed to make of this connection, but it does have at least a resemblance to this idea of like a destiny, that like there was this sort of destiny that he would draw in this way and, have this physical effect of astigmatism, that these are sort of intertwined with each other.
I was reading about Bousquet recently, and it really seemed like he, from accounts from people who knew him, he seems to have considered himself lucky to have been sort of grievously injured, and his wound really became he was able to consider it like a kind of talisman and something around which he could rearrange his life. Although obviously I'm sure it was, I'm sure it would be very difficult to do, but he really is an impressive and inspiring guy.
Yeah, I was reading something like maybe a year or two ago that was talking about people that that do suffer paralysis as a result of, injury or stroke or whatever. And there's been a lot of improvement in the last like 20, 30 years in terms of like care of people who are paralyzed. There's specific tools that are like designed for people who are paralyzed, where you can use eye movements or movements of facial muscles to control like a computer screen. And so the people who they can write emails and, read books, et cetera. you know, using, even though they're paralyzed, like from the neck down, but using these tools. And there was one study, I can't remember when it was from, or like what the, you know, where the subjects were from, but like the study that like evaluated people's you know, life satisfaction, you know, people who were paralyzed. And of course, like shortly after the injury or event or whatever, they have like a very poor life satisfaction, that they, you know, they've experienced this traumatic event and, you know, upended their whole life. But, you know, after a few months, they sort of recover and they actually have like pretty similar levels of life, of reported life satisfaction as like people who are not paralyzed. Yeah, so like even what we would think of as like this, you know, catastrophic experience of, you know, being confined to a bed for the rest of your life and only being able to interact with the world by, you know, moving your facial muscles, people are able to, you know, adapt to this and even, you know, find ways to pursue things that they're interested in, and, you know, at least have some like a more or less normal like degree of satisfaction with their lives. So yeah, it's pretty it's interesting how like the extent to which we can adapt to things and like figure out a way to you know, make our way through situations that, you know, previously we probably would have never expected to be able to like find satisfaction in. Yeah, this is cool. So Bats has posted a little story here in the chat about someone who lost a hand and after the injury got into playing fighting games and like took satisfaction in how difficult it was to learn how to play these games, you know, with one hand. Yeah, and he's also like very good at it. So yeah, sometimes like just the fact of like, you know, having this challenge that other people don't have, like sort of motivates you to, you know, try things that other people maybe wouldn't try, or like, you know, think about things in a different way, and allows you to like, you know, develop techniques that other people would never have thought of. You know, the fact that you have to do something with only one hand means you like figure out like what's the most efficient way to move your hand from one place to the other, and other people don't really have the incentive to think about that. And that gives you that like, you know, split second advantage to be able to beat the other player. So yeah, it's not like losing a hand is like a positive experience, of course, but like it can sort of serve as the incitation or invitation, I guess, to like explore something that you would not have explored otherwise, and develop, you know, strategies and techniques that other people wouldn't have thought to even try.
Yeah, this is a bit of an aside, but I think this idea that, you know, in the sections that Bats read, that this unity sort of depends on the components, and that the unity and the integration of the components, even though it's a complete integration, it changes when the components change. It does sound a lot like Deleuze and disjunctive synthesis, which makes me wonder again how far Deleuze really is from Hegel from some angles, but that's a bit tangential.
Yeah, I don't think he'd be happy with that suggestion. He's definitely like
definitely not.
Yeah. I mean, in his published writings, he doesn't talk about Hegel very much. Like, he only mentions him a few times, but like some of his lecture courses are recorded. They're up online. You can download them. And yeah, he's pretty dismissive of Hegel in some of those courses. And yeah, this was like sort of the style of the time, of course, that like a lot of people were sort of considered themselves to be anti-Hegelian. You know, in the 60s and 70s, Foucault, for example. But yeah, there's like, I don't think it's like completely a distortion to say that there's like this kind of like roundabout way of getting back to Hegel that you can find in Deleuze, that like, yeah, he's doing everything he can to be like anti-Hegelian, but he ends up like just sort of redoing Hegel in certain respects. Yeah, I don't think that would be like a completely like arbitrary and unjustified way of approaching Deleuze.
Yeah, definitely. He's also interestingly pretty overtly critical of Merleau-Ponty in some places, like in the cinema books. But I, you know, similarly, I don't think he's as far from Merleau-Ponty as he would like to make himself out to be.
Yeah, there's a bit in What is Philosophy, where he talks about, well, he's talking about the later Merleau-Ponty, this notion of the flesh. And he's, yeah, again, it's fairly dismissive in that passage. He sort of described it as like this sort of hybrid of like this sort of sensual concept and then this like very Christian kind of course, there's this whole, you know, Christian imagery around the flesh. So this like quasi-religious, quasi-sensual concept that sort of, yeah, is not really doing what it's supposed to do. It's kind of, you can maybe see some of these negative or critical comments about Merleau-Ponty as, again, this sort of like attempt to distance himself from something that he like maybe obscurely realizes is maybe not quite as distant as he would like. Yeah, and of course, they're coming out of like very similar sort of intellectual context. I mean, Deleuze has like, you know, some like, you know, Spinoza is not really like an important reference for Merleau-Ponty in the way that it is for Deleuze, but like, yeah, this like, you know, Bergson as like an important influence, and you know, they're both like in this sort of elite Parisian university context, and you know, interacting with painting and novels, like they both have like a lot to say about Proust, for example. So there's a lot of like similar, you know, threads of thought and intellectual resources that they're appealing to and trying to use, and so it's not that surprising that they like end up with like some things that are maybe more similar than either of them would necessarily have recognized. Yeah, I've been trying to work my way up to rereading Proust because it's a bit of a endeavor to to embark on. I want to make sure that I am prepared to read a 1200 page novel or whatever it is. Obviously he's extremely important for, you know, French philosophy as a whole in the 20th century. And, you know, pretty much everyone is like, you know, reading that book and responding to it and so on. It's something I want to get to. Maybe at some point we can like try to do a reading, maybe not like quite as sort of regular and detailed as we're doing here, but like, yeah, in some sort of like regular meeting on Proust so we can all sort of keep each other on track. That would be maybe a good idea. Maybe the last bit on Proust is that like just the structure of the book does make it a little bit easier than maybe some other books to just sort of pick it up and you know, come to it again after a month or a few weeks or whatever, because you have these like 100 page passages that are just like his description of one conversation and everything that comes to mind as he's thinking about, as he's talking with someone, and like what's the backstory of this like train of thought that he had and so on. Like, so it's not like, you know, you have to sort of keep track of like the intricate, you know, plot developments as you're reading. It's like a lot of it is sort of these like associations and like the, you know, like one of the key sort of motifs is this notion of habit and how like a person is sort of constructed out of these habits that emerge over time. This sort of general, I guess, structure of the book makes it a little bit easier to just sort of dip in and out over a period of, you know, months, rather than, you know, continually reading a certain amount every day or whatever. So maybe we can go on to the next bit. So we're at Let Us Consider, is that right? At the bottom of 204. 61, are you prepared to read today or do you want to just listen? Bottom of 204. Let us consider a subject. Oh, that was weird. There was a thing that said that like your mute symbol just turned into an exclamation mark and then turned back to a mute symbol. I don't know what's going on. Do you want, are you
Hello.
Set up now or?
Okay. Should we come back to you? Bottom of 204.
Yeah. Okay.
Let us consider a subject turns his eyes towards a sensible object placed in front of him. Our preceding remarks permit us to say that the consecutive modification of his perceptual field is not an effect of the physical phenomenon of excitation or of the corresponding physiological phenomenon. We have shown that the most remarkable characteristics of the perceived object, its distance, its size, its apparent color, cannot be deduced from the physiological antecedents of perception. The modern theory of nerve functioning relates them to a transverse phenomena, of which there is neither a physical nor a physiological definition, and which are conceived precisely by borrowing from the perceived world and the image of its descriptive properties. It becomes impossible to assign a somatic substrate of perception. The elaboration of stimuli and the distribution of motor influxes are accomplished according to articulations proper to the phenomenal field. What is introduced under the name of transverse phenomena is in reality the perceived field itself. For us, this signifies that the living body and the nervous system, instead of being like annexes of the physical world, in which the occasional causes of perception would be prepared, are phenomena emerging from among those which consciousness knows. Perceptual behavior, as science studies it, is not defined in terms of nerve cells and synapses. It is not in the brain or even in the body. Science has not been able to construct the central sectors of behavior from the outside, like something which is enclosed in a cranial box. It can understand it only as a dialectic, the moments of which are not stimuli and movements, but phenomenal objects and actions. The illusion of a transitive operation of stimuli on the sensory apparatus, and of the latter against consciousness, comes from the fact that we actualize separately the physical body, the body of the anatomists, or even the organism of the physiologists, all of which are abstractions, snapshots taken from the functional body.
Oh, sorry, I thought you were going to keep going. Yeah, there's no like good stopping point here. Do you want to read it maybe another couple paragraphs?
Sure, yeah. You distracted me by your post in the text chat. But okay.
No, sorry.
When its existence is accepted, the hallucinatory image is no longer treated in recent works as an isolated phenomenon, which could be explained by some irritation of center. It is connected with the whole organic vegetative functioning, which is to say that rather than a perception without object, hallucination is a global conduct related to a global alteration of nerve functioning. It supposes a complete structure, the description of which, like that of normal functioning, cannot be given in somatic terms. The somatic events do not act directly. Section of the optic nerve can be called the cause of blindness, only in the sense in which Beethoven's deafness explains his last works. It provokes a change of the phenomenal field, only by rendering impossible the functioning of the whole of the cortex under the action of luminous excitant. Is it this functioning itself which can be considered as a cause? No, if it is understood as the sum of the nerve events which are produced in each point of the cortex. This whole can be only the condition of existence of such and such a sensible scene. It accounts for the fact that I perceive, but not for that which I perceive, not for the scene as such, since this latter is presupposed in a complete definition of the nerve process. Everything takes place as if my perception opened out on a network of original significations. The passage of nerve influx in such and such conductors does not produce the visible scene. It does not even determine its structure in a univocal manner, since it is organized according to laws of equilibrium, which are neither those of a physical system nor those of the body considered as such. The somatic substrate is the passage point, the base of a dialectic. In the same way, nobody thinks of explaining the content of a delirium by its physiological condition, even though this form of consciousness presupposes in extendo some alteration of the brain. Speaking generally, it seems that we are rejoining the critical idea. Whatever the external conditions may be, bodily, psychological, social, upon which the development of consciousness depends, and even if it is only gradually constituted in history, the history itself out of which it comes is only a view which consciousness gives itself with regard to the acquired consciousness of self. A reversal of perspective is produced vis-a-vis adult consciousness. The historical becoming which prepared it was not before it. It is only for it. The time during which it progressed is no longer the time of its constitution, but a time which it constitutes, and the series of events is subordinated to its eternity. Such is the perpetual reply of critical thought to psychologism, sociologism, and historicism.
Yeah, so he's going through some of the things that we were talking about earlier about how, like, so the case of section of the optic nerve or, you know, in general, some sort of damage that changes my perceptual capacities can't just be understood as, like, something that has this strictly causal connection to, you know, my perception of the world and my behavior in relation to the world. It has to be set into the context of my whole sort of mode of behavior, my structure of my behavior, and like my, I guess, life project in general. That, you know, like obviously for Beethoven to become deaf is something very different than for someone who, I don't know, like a carpenter or whatever, to become deaf. That, you know, of course, that's still something that is, you know, a serious impact on the carpenter in terms of that person's interaction with other people and so on, but quite different than for a composer who, you know, where sound and you know, being able to hear is like a central part of his life project. So this is like a depiction of these kinds of seemingly contingent or, you know, physical effects on a person's perceptual experience and, you know, interaction with the world and so on, as actually having to be understood in terms of signification. And even in these animal studies that he's described in earlier parts of the book, you can't understand the effect of, you can't understand animal perception without understanding what is significant for those animals. And he's talking about how, like, the sort of general state of the animal, whether it's hungry or excited or tired or whatever, these sort of general conditions of the animal affect what kinds of things it can perceive and what kinds of behavior it's capable of performing. So you can't, even at the level of, you know, behavior of rats in a maze or whatever, you can't understand their perceptual grasp of the world and their behavioral interaction with the world just in terms of like physical stimuli. And that's, you know, even more so in the case of humans who, you know, understand the, you know, their behavioral capacities following this injury or this change. They understand this in terms of some sort of life narrative or, you know, making sense of what happened to me and so on. So this is like sort of what we were describing before. He wants to, like, he's sort of developing this whole part of the book in terms of how he wants to distinguish his position from the criticist or intellectualist position. So he's talking here about, like, as an adult or as someone who has, you know, had certain experiences in my life, I will, you know, make sense of those experiences, even if they were at some level just like these chance phenomena. The fact that a shell happened to land near where I was stationed as a soldier, that, you know, left me paralyzed and changed the whole course of my life. This is a contingent event. And in some sense, there's no like meaning, there's no intrinsic reason why this shell landed here and not somewhere else that would have left me, unscathed. But at the same time, I, you know, from where I am now, like looking retrospectively at my life, I see this injury and my paralysis as like this sort of defining moment that changes the whole meaning of my life, that does have this meaning. And the way that like a sort of criticist, position would interpret this is that there's like this, again, sort of subject floating outside of the world in this mysterious way that would sort of constitute the life course as an object of thought, as something that has this, you know, structure of being meaningful. So this atemporal subject is sort of watching this little film of, or that's not even the right, image, because watching a film involves something like a temporal experience, but this is like something outside of time, you know, stitching together these images into something that resemble a film of a person's life that has some sort of narrative structure and meaning to it. But this is something that, this sort of temporal sequence is something that is not itself a product of an experience that happens in time. It's something that the subject is sort of constituting as a temporal sequence. And so this is like a rejection of all these types of explanations that would say that, you know, my experience today is a product of, say, my early childhood or the, you know, historical era in which I find myself, that, you know, I'm sort of shaped by the culture in which I was raised, and that makes me experience the world in a certain way, etc. It's sort of a rejection of any type of explanation along these lines that would sort of subordinate my present consciousness to an explanation in terms of how it developed or how it was conditioned by circumstances that are not themselves meaningful or that are not themselves part of my consciousness. Something that would say, like, you know, these historical, cultural, you know, forces or structures or whatever have made it the case that I experience the world in this way. This is like completely antithetical to this criticist tradition that would instead take something like a historical process or some sort of cultural conditioning as as an object of thought, as something that, you know, as a historian, as a, you know, art historian or whatever, you can perform this intellectual construction that, you know, there's this, I don't know, romantic style or neo-Gothic style or whatever. This is an object of thought as opposed to something that could bring about your consciousness, your, you know, present form of thinking about the world. So it's a, yeah, we have to sort of thread the needle of avoiding the like causal, supposedly naturalistic account of the world, where like I would just sort of explain my perception of the world and my behavior in terms of causal effects on me of these objects outside of me. And then also at the same time, Merleau-Ponty wants to avoid this criticist or intellectualist position that would sort of empty out the subject and leave it as this sort of pure subject outside the world that constitutes everything as its object. We have to find a way of like avoiding each side and finding an alternate path. Sorry, I'm just posting something in the chat here while we just give me a second. Maybe just do one more section and then we can wrap up. I can read this one. This discussion of causal thinking has seemed valid to us, and we have pursued it at all levels of behavior. It leads, as we have just said, to the transcendental attitude. This is the first conclusion which we have to draw from the preceding chapters. It is not the only one, and it would even be necessary to say that this first conclusion stands in a relation of simple homonymy with a philosophy in the critical tradition. What is profound in the notion of quote-unquote Gestalt, from which we started, not the idea of signification, but that of structure, the joining of an idea and an existence which are indiscernible, the contingent arrangement by which materials begin to have meaning in our presence, intelligibility in the nascent state. The study of the reflex has shown us that the nervous system is the place in which an order without anatomical guarantee is realized by means of a continuing organization. It already permitted us to establish a rigorously reciprocal relation between function and substrate, there was not an area which was not linked in its functioning to the global activity of a nervous system, but also not a function which was not profoundly altered by the subtraction of a single one of these areas. And function was nothing outside the process which is delineated at each instant and which, based on the nerve mass, organizes itself. The study of the, quote, central sector, unquote, of behavior confirmed this ambiguity of bodily nature. On the one hand, it appeared that absolutely no function could be localized, since each region plays a role only in the context of a global activity, and since the diverse movements which it governs correspond to several modes of qualitatively distinct functioning, rather than to several locally differentiated devices. On the other hand, it was equally clear that certain parts of the nerve substance are indispensable for the reception of certain stimuli, that the execution of certain movements are assigned to certain receptive regions or to some muscular ensemble, and that even when nerve substance is not the depository of any special power of this kind, there can be no substitution for the nerve substance in each place. Thus, we were dealing less with two types of localization than with an inextricable intersecting of horizontal, quote-unquote horizontal, and quote-unquote vertical localizations, without the body being anywhere pure thing, but also without it being anywhere pure idea. It is not possible to designate separate contributions of the visual and auditive regions of the brain. Both function only with the center, and integral thinking transfigures the hypothetical, quote, visual contents, unquote, and, quote unquote, auditive contents to the point of rendering them unrecognizable. But also the alteration of one of these regions is manifested in thought by a determinate deficit. It is the intuition of simultaneous wholes or that of successive wholes which becomes impossible. Thus, the integration of the optic or auditive regions in a functional whole, although it infuses the corresponding contents with a new signification, does not annul their specificity. It uses and sublimates it. For life, as for the mind, there is no past which is absolutely past. Quote, the moments which the mind seems to have behind it are also born in its present depths. That sounds like a Hegel quote, but yeah, maybe someone can check that. Higher behavior retains the subordinate dialectics in the present depths of its existence, from that of the physical and its topographical conditions to that of the organism and its quote-unquote milieu. They are not recognizable in the whole when it functions correctly, but the disintegration in case of partial lesion attests to their imminence. There is no essence of thinking which would receive the particular forms of, quote, visual thought, unquote, and, quote, auditive thought, unquote, by a contingency of our nerve organization and as a condition of existence. The alleged conditions of existence are indiscernible in the whole with which they collaborate, and reciprocally, the existence of the whole cannot be concretely conceptualized without them and without its constitutive history. Consequently, the relations of matter and form in the object organism and the relations of the soul and body were found to be conceived differently than in critical thought. I thought this was like wrapping up, but there's a few more pages than I thought. Maybe I'll just read a little bit more. I went back too far. Bear with me. Right, okay. While critical philosophy having step-by-step repressed quality and existence, residues of its ideal analysis, to place them finally in a matter about which nothing can be thought and which is for us, therefore, as if it were not, deploys a homogeneous activity of the understanding from one end of knowledge to the other. Each formation, mise en forme, appears to us, on the contrary, to be an event in the world of ideas, the institution of a new dialectic, the opening of a new region of phenomena, and the establishment of a new constitutive layer which eliminates the preceding one as isolated moment but conserves and integrates it. While critical thought pushed the problem of the relations of the soul and body back step by step by showing that we never deal with a body in itself, en soi, but with a body for a consciousness, and that thus we never have to put consciousness in contact with an opaque and foreign reality. For us, consciousness experiences its inherence in an organism at each moment. For it is not a question of an inherence in material apparatuses, which, as a matter of fact, can be only objects for consciousness, but of a presence to consciousness of its proper history and of the dialectical stages which it has traversed. Therefore, we could not accept any of the materialistic models to represent the relations of the soul and body, but neither could we accept the mentalistic models, for example, the Cartesian metaphor of the artisan and his tool. An organ cannot be compared to an instrument, as if it existed and could be conceived apart from integral functioning, nor the mind to an artisan who uses it. This would be to return to a wholly external relation like that of the pilot and his ship, which was rightly rejected by Descartes. The mind does not use the body, but realizes itself through it, while at the same time transferring the body outside of physical space. When we were describing the structures of behavior, it was indeed to show that they are irreducible to the dialectic of physical stimulus and muscular contraction, and that in this sense, behavior, far from being a thing which exists in itself, en soi, is a whole significative for our consciousness which considers it. But it was at the same time and reciprocally to make manifest in, quote, expressive conduct, unquote, the view of a consciousness under our eyes to show a mind which comes into the world. Let's stop here because, yeah, this is like a long bit. A couple more pages. Man, this is long. Okay. The last bit about like this expressive nature of behavior, I think, is important and very Hegelian. It's not like an accident that he's, you know, quoting Hegel here. This idea that in action, or you know, Hegel uses the term action, Merleau-Ponty is extending this to include not just humans, but animal behavior as well, but that action involves a kind of externalization of reason or mind or spirit or whatever term we want to use. But as a person, I can, you know, have an intention. I can think, you know, it'd be nice if I wrote a great poem or, you know, achieved some great political project or whatever. But you know, as long as this is just something in my mind, it's this completely sort of abstract and essentially imaginary project or, you know, idea. And it's something completely different to, you know, actually execute the task of writing that poem or performing that political project or whatever it is, and, you know, take it and make it into something that exists outside of me, that is not just, you know, dependent on the fact that I'm imagining this scenario in my mind, but that other people can interact with and that exists independently of me. So what this action, you know, performing an action, takes this idea or intention or whatever it is from the state of this like imaginary existence that depends on me, that, you know, it only exists insofar as I'm thinking of it, and turning it into something external to me. But that external entity is still meaningful. It has that structure of signification to it. So a poem that I've written down and, I don't know, published or shared with someone or whatever is not just, you know, a sequence of, you know, ink marks on paper. It's something that has meaning and value of some kind. Even if it's not an especially good poem, it still is not just, you know, a set of, you know, ink configurations on paper. It has this nature of being external to me, of being something that has its own existence, but at the same time of being meaningful and of yeah, having this structure of signification. And so Merleau-Ponty is going to use the same sort of schema of this like externalization of meaning, where when as the observer, you know, watching someone perform some kind of action, it could be in like a psychology lab where I'm asking people to, you know, press a button when they see a triangle or whatever, which is kind of a very like banal and simplified form of behavior, but it's still human behavior of some kind. Or it could be I'm watching some kind of artistic performance, which is like a much more, you know, important kind of human behavior. But in either case, I'm observing a signification sort of becoming an external reality, something that is manifested and not just sort of inside the mind of a person and dependent on that person for its existence. And so this is sort of why behavior is this like key concept for Merleau-Ponty, why he's written this whole book about it, is that it's something that is neither purely in my mind, which would sort of lead us to this like criticist position, right, where everything is an object of my thought. It's part of this, you know, intellectual depiction of the world. Nor is behavior something that is purely material. It's not just something that I can reduce to like the movement of certain portions of matter in geometrical space. So it's something that is like this signification that is external to me or to any individual person. And so it's that, yeah, this kind of, I mean, the Hegelian term would be like objective spirit. It's something that, yeah, has this meaningfulness. It's spiritual in that sense, but also is something that is not subjective. It's objective in the sense that it's outside of any person. So yeah, behavior as like the most fundamental form of objective spirit, I think, is what Merleau-Ponty is pointing towards in this part here. Yeah. So yeah, I think it's a good place to stop. So yeah, we'll continue with this. But yeah, I think how many more pages do we have? 17 more pages, I believe. So yeah, we can probably finish in 2 to 3 weeks. I put the link to the Rouillet book, the cybernetics one, in the other chat. So that's, unless anyone has like some like firm objections to reading that next, I think we can decide that that's the next one to read. So if you want to take a look at that and like take a, you know, get prepared. Thanks everyone, and see you next week.